Welcome to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Ahead this hour, we get essential information about voting in Pennsylvania November 3rd from Secretary of the Commonwealth Kathy Buchvar. Also, Chester's homicide rate is on the rise. We'll learn about a new focused deterrence program, which tries to turn high-risk youth away from gun violence. But to begin, health officials predicted a rise in coronavirus cases this fall, and their forecast is proving to be accurate. The number of new cases in both Pennsylvania and New Jersey last Thursday was the highest for either state for a single day since May. And officials in both states are expressing concern that a second wave of COVID-19 lies just ahead. Are we prepared? WHYY's Kenneth Burns has been covering the New Jersey story for us, and he joins us now on the Regional Roundup. Kenny, good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
So we were in the thick of it in May, and it's certainly troublesome that the caseload recently has been hitting similar numbers. Let's focus on this past Thursday. How many people were newly confirmed to have COVID-19 in New Jersey on that day?
Now, keep in mind, this is the highest daily case count that we've had since about May 29th. So 1,301 confirmed COVID-19 cases this past Thursday. Ocean County accounted for about 22% of those cases, or 285. Monmouth County was right behind with about 10%, or about 128 cases.
And we're going to get into that breakout in just a bit. But first, you know, give us a total. How many cases have there been in the Garden State since this all began?
Since this all began, the first case was reported around March 4th. 213,628, and I apologize for using the exact number, but I think that's an ideal to illustrate how many people have been infected. And that was since the first case was reported. It was a physician assistant who worked in New York, and he lived in Fort Lee, which is in North Jersey. And it should be noted that, and this will come out a little bit later today, that you have New York City and North Jersey really right next to each other.
Total
at 213,628 was as of Sunday. The number of mortalities, 14,386 since the first death was reported on March 10th. Now, the first death was a little bit notable. John Brennan, he lived in Little Ferry, but he was also a mainstay in the paddock of the Yonkers Raceway in New York State. So, and this was, again, we had the update yesterday. There were another 751 new cases reported on Sunday, and then three confirmed deaths.
Yeah, sobering numbers, Kenny. What are health officials saying about why we're seeing an uptick in COVID-19 in New Jersey?
Not one particular event. They did note a couple of items. Judy Persichelli, who is the state health commissioner, she noted that there were several religious gatherings towards the end of September. And she also noted that there were informal gatherings of college students. So those were the two main driving factors, particularly in Ocean, Monmouth, and Middlesex County. The Orthodox Jewish population has grown exponentially in Ocean County, particularly in Lakewood. In fact, Governor Murphy has so far defended them, quite honestly, because he called out straight up, don't even think about doing any type of anti-Semitic attacks. It also should be noted that we've seen a couple of outbreaks within that population, not just in New Jersey, but in New York City as well. And then the college students. Remember, you have Rutgers, New Brunswick, and Middlesex County. Yeah. Princeton, just over the line in Mercer County. Stockton and Ocean County, as well as Georgia and Court University, a smaller Catholic institution. And then you have Monmouth University in Monmouth County. So all these students that are actually on campus are informally getting together. So those are the main driving factors that officials have noted.
A couple of real coronavirus hotspots in the state. How is New Jersey prepared to tackle this expected second wave of coronavirus? And what were the lessons learned from the first wave, Kenny?
Right now, they're stockpiling PPE, antiviral medication like remdesivir, which is what was given to President Trump when he was hospitalized in Walter Reed. I think that's the main lesson, because I remember I live in Mercer County, and when they issued the mask mandate, masks were a little bit hard to come by, and a lot of the stores like Home Depot, they were saving them for the state to send those along. So just stockpiling supplies and making sure that we have everything in place. And then the other thing to keep in mind, We do not have the out-of-state medical workers that we had earlier this year.
Why is that?
They are back home in their in their home states, fighting the same fight that
makes sense.
That the medical workers in New Jersey are fighting. So that's the main concern for health officials, because if you go down, or if a medical staffer, either a nurse or a support staffer, if they go down, that's going to really have an effect on how many people are available to fight this pandemic.
Also worth noting, Kenny Burns, the state is receiving the first shipment of over 2 million rapid COVID tests from the federal government. I think it's called, if I'm pronouncing this correctly, the Binax Now.
You nailed it.
Okay, which Governor Murphy says can deliver results in about 15 minutes. How will this be distributed?
Right now, it's being distributed to schools and underserved communities at first. Obviously, some of those tests are going to go to Ocean County, as well as Middlesex and Monmouth counties, because those are the hot spots right now. This is the first shipment, about 170,000 being sent, and it's going to add up to 2.6 million over the next few weeks.
As you reported, the rate of transmission in New Jersey is 1.22. What does that mean?
So, and keep in mind, math is not my strong suit.
Mine neither.
So 1.22. So at that time, for every 10 people who are infected, it will pass along to around 11 or 12 people. So, and the most recent RT, or rate of transmission, is 1.17. So for every 10 people, they pass it to 12 other people. Or just tick up, move the decimal point. For every 100 people that are infected with COVID-19, you're talking about at least 117 people getting infected from those original 100.
Okay, thanks for clearing that up. Bottom line, Kenny, is prevention still largely up to the individual, according to the state?
For the most part, yes. Keep in mind, New Jersey still has some of the COVID protocols or mandates. You have to wear your mask in public if you're in a store or a public building. But outside of that, of course, we have to make the only exception is when you're dining indoors or outdoors at this point. But protection or prevention is still largely up to the individual, whether they wear the mask or not, whether they honor the travel advisory. Remember, it's voluntary, but compliance is expected, as Judy Persichelli would say. Is still very much an honor system.
Is asymptomatic spread a significant factor in this increase in cases in New Jersey? What are health officials saying?
They're saying it is, and that is one of the lessons learned from earlier this year, and they're starting to see it more, particularly among younger people. And if you recall, over the summer, we've seen an uptick in cases among young people, particularly those 19 to 29 years old. In fact, we saw a lot of the cases, and this is why they made a big deal about not having the big house parties that you would normally have during the summer, and how they were cracked down. It's definitely the young people, and they did a lot of appealing to young people. Wear the PPE, mask up, don't have these large parties. Smaller gatherings, that's fine, but it was the big parties. And then the other factor to keep in mind that we haven't talked about yet, it's getting colder.
Yeah.
So
we're moving indoors. Yeah.
Exactly. So they are going to keep an eye out for that, as far as telling people to be careful as you have these events indoors now that it's getting colder.
Let's get back to the travel advisory list that you mentioned a little bit earlier. It seems as if cases in New Jersey continue to trend upwards, the state might qualify for its own list.
Yes, indeed.
In a weird way.
This was an NJ.com analysis of it. Now, Governor Murphy was actually asked about it on Thursday. He said they're trying to stay below the line. What is that line? It's either an average daily number of new cases higher than 10 per 100,000 residents, or this positivity rate is 10% or higher, and these are both over a 7-day average. And interesting to note, it's not exactly New Jersey's travel advisory list. It's the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut travel advisory list. Because of, and remember what I said earlier about the New York area being sort of ground zero for this pandemic in the United States, they are working in concert on that travel list, and the New York State Health Department is actually doing the calculations to find out who's on and who's off. Right now, it's about 35 states and territories, including, as far as our tri-state area, Delaware. Pennsylvania is safe.
Okay. Seems as if there's an app for just about everything, and there is one to help New Jerseyans determine whether they have been exposed to COVID. Tell us about this one, Kenny.
COVID Alert NJ, and I actually was playing with it last night. You could get it wherever you get your apps. If you're an iPhone person like I am or Android, it launched earlier this month. Here's how it works. It communicates through Bluetooth, and it doesn't collect any private data or anything. It pretty much talks to another phone that has the app. That's the key thing. The other phone has to have the app as well. And the two phones talk to each other through secure anonymous codes. And if you were in the vicinity of someone for 10 minutes or longer or within 6 feet, it will let you know that you might have been possibly exposed to COVID. Here's the kicker. Not enough people have downloaded it.
Okay.
So this past Thursday, Governor Murphy and Commissioner Persichelli had made the appeal for more residents to download this app.
Free app.
And even when you install it, and it'll give you a bunch of disclaimers, quite honestly. Can we collect your data? Can we log the information from other phones? So you will be able to read through this so you know how the app works and what it does and what it does not do.
How have you found the app in playing around with it?
Pretty easy, actually. You have the stats. You have the information in case you need to call somebody. And that's the other thing to keep in mind as far as your own personal care. You could check the symptoms. And if you talk to someone from the health department, you could send them an anonymous code. And, I mean, if they get a high marks, as the commissioner noted a couple of weeks ago.
All right. One more note before we wrap up. Short while back, Kenny, you reported on a proposal from U.S. Senator Bob Menendez for a bipartisan commission to evaluate the country's response to the pandemic. Tell us briefly about this. We've got about 40 seconds.
Similar to the 9/11 commission, it'll look into the government response and very tough as far as ethics. You cannot be a part of the government and be on the commission. And each party will have about this, actually the same amount of choices as far as who makes up the commission. So it's truly bipartisan. Senator Menendez says that he has gotten support for it.
So you cannot be on the government to be on this commission.
Well, you can't be on the government responding to the pandemic.
Oh, okay. Just to clarify. So who are we talking about then?
Let's chart this again.
You hear the music. we'll revisit this at some point. Good to know that the commission has been proposed. Kenneth Burns, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having
Regional
me.
Roundup. Kenneth Burns is South Jersey reporter for WHYY. Up next, we've got Pennsylvania Secretary of the Commonwealth, Kathy Buchbar, on the general election. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Nearly 9 million people have registered to vote in Pennsylvania, which could be an all-time high. And as questions continue to swirl around the voting process, we've asked Pennsylvania Secretary of the Commonwealth, Kathy Buchbar, to weigh in on mail-in balloting for the November 3rd general election. How it works, the pitfalls of not doing vote by mail correctly, like sending in so-called naked ballots and missed deadlines, also security concerns and much more. Kathy Buchbar, Pennsylvania Secretary of the Commonwealth, welcome to the Regional Roundup.
Thanks so much for having me on the show.
So broad question to begin. Do you feel Pennsylvania is ready for an unprecedented general election in which the majority of ballots might be mailed in or placed in ballot drop boxes?
It is truly remarkable, and the answer is yes. The counties in this Commonwealth are, the county election officials are the most dedicated, hardworking, incredible public servants that I have ever had the pleasure to work with. in my life. And combining them with the dedication and commitment of the Department of State overseeing this whole process, it's been just a tremendous effort. And, you know, we've already seen over 2.5 million Pennsylvanians apply for their mail-in or absentee ballots this year. You know, I expect it's going to be somewhere in the range of 3 million. So I think you're right. We're looking at probably approximately 50% of the electorate may well apply or vote by mail.
During the primary in June, Kathy, more voters mailed their ballots than showed up at the polls. What was learned from this experience that is now being applied to November 3rd?
So many things. So I think the most important thing, really, in many ways, was how much staffing and equipment needs to be bumped up in order to account for this. So you may know we ended up with about 1.5 million Pennsylvanians who voted by mail in the primary. And the last presidential primary, we had 84,000. So we went from 84,000 to nearly 1.5 million all in one election cycle. We don't have to do that more than once. That happened in the primary, and the counties got to see what's involved in processing that number of ballots. And they've gotten more equipment. They've upped their staffing. They've upped their practices. And they have gotten their ballots in the mail much earlier than they did in the primary.
Well, let's get to some concerns about mailing a ballot in. Once a mail-in ballot is marked and sent back inside, it is sent back inside two envelopes, an inner and an outer envelope. And it is incredibly important to use what's called the secrecy envelope, because if a ballot does not have that envelope, if it's a so-called naked ballot, it'll be tossed. Is this an enormous concern for you? There are concerns. Critics say maybe tens of thousands of votes might be discarded in this swing state.
You know, it's a concern, but I have to say I'm so thankful for all the public education out there, in addition to the public education that we are doing at the Department of State. So we have put out bilingual, you know, materials, TV, radio, you know, digital ads that just in general talk about vote by mail. But of course, once the Pennsylvania Supreme Court came out with this decision in September, we've bumped all the communications around this naked ballot issue. And you've probably seen, and some of our listeners, I'm sure, have seen that some people are being very creative with the advertising on this and are actually doing naked ads to demonstrate how important it is to not have your ballots be naked. So I'm going to keep my advertising clothed because we want all ballots to be clothed. So just, it's not complicated. Everybody just needs to remember when you get your ballot, you'll receive two envelopes, an inner white secrecy envelope, and an outer pre-printed return address envelope. Put your ballot, after you fill it out, put it in the inner white envelope, seal it, and then put that inner white envelope in the outer envelope and make sure you sign your voter's declaration and fill out that information before you return it. Very easy. Just don't skip any steps of the envelopes and the signing on the outside.
Pennsylvania and New Jersey are among just 16 states, I believe. And your confidence in this notwithstanding, is it time to retire secrecy envelopes because of the risk that some people might not follow the exact procedure?
Yeah, you know, I think it's a great idea. What I've learned is that I think we're the only state in the country that does not count naked ballots. So even of the ones that do have secrecy envelopes, they recognize that, you know, simple mistakes that don't, you know, that aren't a fraud, you know, issue of fraud or an issue of ineligibility should not prevent people from being able to vote. But based on the laws in place in Pennsylvania, this would require legislative change. So, yes, I'd love to see the legislature either change the rules on requiring envelopes, the second envelope altogether, or just verify that, in fact, these ballots should be counted because, look, they're there for a good reason. They are there to protect voter secrecy, which is enshrined in the Pennsylvania Constitution. So it's not for naught that it exists, but we shouldn't disenfranchise people as a result of it.
Let's get to the enormous job of counting ballots. State House Republicans apparently have begun discussing the concept of allowing counties to start processing mail-in ballots several days ahead of Election Day. The clock is ticking to get legislation approved and signed. Is it critical that this happen?
So it is. It's really the single most important factor for us to ensure that results are known, you know, it's very, you know, if not on election night, extremely soon thereafter. And it's such a simple solution. We've been advocating for this since February. I mean, months and months of saying we need to make sure that the counties have sufficient time. If they're receiving 10 times as many ballots by mail, we don't want it to take 10 times as long to count them. And this is simple math. So we've been advocating for this. This is an easy solution. You know, I'm still going to remain hopeful that this happens, but we are running out of time. And I will tell you, even if it doesn't happen, this is not something that is going to take, I do not expect this to take weeks in Pennsylvania. Many counties are planning to keep counting 24/7 until the count is done. And though I don't wish that on anybody, it is another demonstration of the dedication of our election officials to make sure we get those results as soon as possible.
What is the hard and fast deadline here?
You know, there is not a hard and fast deadline, but because, you know, if we're talking about amount of day, I mean, obviously we were advocating for 21 days for the counties to have the most flexibility for counting, because you could imagine that a small county like Sullivan County is going to have many fewer mail-in ballots than a county like Philadelphia. So we were advocating for 3 weeks. We are now, tomorrow is 3 weeks for election day. So we've run out of time for that. But if you're talking about 5 days, 7 days, 9 days, those are all still doable. But the counties need time to prepare the staffing and the public notice for those events to occur.
Let's talk about the role of partisan observers and how they might affect the count. In Philadelphia, there's apparently new automated ballot reading equipment, and officials are to begin an around-the-clock effort to process mail-in ballots at 7 a.m. election day. You know, apparently the Trump campaign wants to scrutinize every envelope looking for errors or omissions, you know, for possible challenges. At what point do campaign people get to observe the process, and can they observe each and every envelope?
No. So there's very specifically defined rights for both poll watchers and party representatives in these processes. So show today is very timely. We just got a very, very important decision from the federal court over the weekend. From the Trump campaign sued me with all kinds of claims about ways in which votes should be restricted. And the court agreed with us that on basically all of the claims. So one of the issues has been about poll watchers, and you've probably seen that in Philadelphia. There was also a separate lawsuit brought about that.
Yeah.
And both courts have agreed with us that poll watchers have very restricted rights. So first of all, poll watchers are not even appointed until a couple days before election day. They only exist in the context of election day, that they can observe voting and make challenges on November 3rd in the polling places. And they can watch the, you know, counting of those votes, the tabulation at the end of the night. And then there are another statutory creation called representatives. So party or candidate representatives are allowed to observe pre-canvassing and canvassing of mail-in and absentee ballots. However, they don't have rights to challenge. And by the way, nobody, no third party has a right to challenge based on signatures at all. And in fact, the court agreed with us that even counties may not reject ballots based on signature changes over time. So it was a very strong decision on those issues, and we're very pleased.
So if a campaign representative is watching the process of the mail-in ballots being counted, and perhaps that person doesn't like the way a certain envelope looks, they can't stop the process down and throw a monkey wrench in and go envelope by envelope with a challenge.
Correct. And we are awaiting, we also brought a similar lawsuit in Pennsylvania Supreme Court, asking the court to issue as a matter of state law a clear decision confirming that, because the other court was a federal court. We want the state court to issue this because it's such an issue of state law, interpretation of state law. So we're waiting for that to confirm, but we expect, you know, that should be a similar confirmation of the law. And Pennsylvania law is very good at making sure that we don't have, you know, baseless challenges. And in fact, all challenges to mail-in and absentee ballots must be made by the Friday before Election Day, and they can only be made on the basis of a voter not being an eligible voter. So, for example, being under 18, or, you know, being not being a resident for the proper amount of time, or not being a citizen. Signature matching is not one of them. And what the envelopes look like is not a basis for challenge. So, no, they cannot do that.
Another complaint President Trump has had, it involves a Luzerne County, and this story's been out for a little bit. A number, I think it's 9 military and overseas ballots, which were discarded in Luzerne County last month. Most of them votes for Trump, feeding into the narrative that that the election is rigged against him. How did this happen, and how can a voter make certain their vote is indeed being counted?
Sure. So, yeah, what happened in Luzerne County was one individual who was hired as a seasonal temporary mailroom employee was not adequately trained. And just to tell you how what a great job the county did in catching it, the individual was hired, you know, I think this happened all in a matter of days, literally, and the ballots were found. It was immediately reported by the county election director, who did a great job. They immediately reported to law enforcement. They immediately started investigating. And the individual, who, again, was just a temporary mailroom employee, was terminated like 2 days later. I mean, within this all happened within a short period of time. So the bad news is that it was a serious error. The good news is they did everything right after they discover it. So the individual is gone. They reached out to law enforcement. They reached out to the Department of State to make sure that we gave all the rest of their staff training on the entire process, what you do. I mean, you know, these ballots, and people should understand, so these were ballots that were overseas ballots that went to remote areas of the globe. And those get sent out in August before the ballots are even certified. So the ballots look different because we don't even know who the candidates are at that point. They're called special write-in ballots. Mm-hmm. The envelopes may also look different because it's before the official election mail goes out. And so the individual made a serious error. The county did everything right afterwards. We've made sure we've already done the training. And, you know, I have every confidence that will continue from here forward.
So you feel the safety net is pretty tight. Okay. Let's get to the nuts and bolts of voting. When is the latest a constituent can register to vote in Pennsylvania?
So 1 week from today, October 19th, is the last day to register to vote. And thank you for pointing out that we are at an all-time high for voter registration. But I really would like to crack 9 million. So please tell everybody you know who may not be registered to vote. They need to register by next Monday, October 19th. They can go online to votespa.com, or they could do it by paper or through the mail or in person. And I hope we can get to, by the way, in-person early voting, which is going on right now.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I would love for every voter to know that in Pennsylvania, thanks to Act 77 passed in the fall, we have more choices to vote than we've ever had in the history of the Commonwealth. So you have three ways you could vote. You could vote by mail, go to votespa.com and apply today. Do not wait. You could vote in person early at your county election offices. Philadelphia has 7 locations that are open every day of the week. So, and many counties around the state have various options available for voters. I voted on Friday, you know, more than 3 weeks ahead of Election Day, and I'm done. My vote is already in.
So, Kathy, may I ask if a voter has not yet registered, can they go to the county election office, register, apply for the ballot, fill it out, and then drop it off all in one trip?
Great question. The answer is yes. So the only thing I would say is if you have time to register online ahead of time, that part of the process takes a little bit longer. So if you get that piece done, the rest of it is quicker, but you can do it all at once as long as you go before next Monday, before October 19th. You could do the entire, all the steps from start to finish in one visit.
And can you do this at satellite offices, or do you have to go to the main county election office? Oh, you can.
No, you can. So all 7 of Philadelphia's election offices, and Montgomery County has about 5, Bucks has 3, Delaware County has a number as well, Chester County has a number. So all in the Philadelphia region, all the counties have opened these satellite offices. They are full service satellite offices. You can do all of the above at them.
Okay. So, and if a voter in Pennsylvania wants to cast their ballot by mail, they need to apply to do so, what is it, by the 27th, correct?
Correct, but do not wait.
That does feel really late.
Yeah. So seriously, I mean, we've all seen so much news about postal service delays.
Yeah.
Do not wait. Just do it. Do it today. Do it tomorrow. Philly is making this super easy by being open 7 days a week. Don't wait.
And also, as a reminder, if you're listening to us as a resident of Delaware, you will also need to request a vote by mail ballot. And in New Jersey, all registered voters are automatically receiving a ballot in the mail. So you kind of referenced this a little bit earlier, Kathy Buchvar, but tell us about the responsibility for making certain every registered voter in Pennsylvania gets a chance to cast a ballot safely and securely. This has to be an enormously stressful time for you and your team.
There was a headline from an article last week, something about me having the most stressful job in Pennsylvania. I have to say that the teams that I talked about at the beginning make this job so much easier because they are so incredible. And, you know, myself and my team, and I can tell you, you know, most of the county election officials across the Commonwealth, we are starting our days really early and working very late and working on weekends. At Department of State, we upped our staff. We upped our customer service and IT support to the county so that we have somebody available 24/7. If they're working 24/7, I want to make sure that our staff is available, you know, as close to 24/7 as possible to make sure every piece of this process gets done. So the security, no matter how you vote, whether you vote by mail, whether you vote in person early, or whether you vote in person on election day, your vote will be safe, secure, and accessible and counted accurately.
All right, Kathy Buchvar, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Kathy is Pennsylvania's Secretary of the Commonwealth. And coming up, we take a close look at the city of Chester and a new program to reduce crime and boost economic activity. Stay with us for more of the Regional Roundup. You're listening to the Regional Roundup.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Up on WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. An uptick in gun violence this year is shattering an increasing number of families and communities. And as various municipalities try to figure out how to stem the deadly conflict, the Delaware County District Attorney's Office is planning to employ a unique strategy in Chester City, a focused deterrent program. Investigators will work to identify the relatively small number of people in the city believed to be responsible for most of the gun violence, and then reach out to them, offering options, help with jobs, therapy, even housing and food. And if that doesn't work, there is the risk of incarceration. We've got two guests for the remainder of the show to talk about the program in depth. Matthew Krause is Deputy District Attorney for Delaware County and will be helping to oversee the program called the Chester Partnership for Safe Neighborhoods. Welcome, Matthew.
Thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
Sure. And Jean-Pierre Bryce is the program's community resource consultant. He'll be working at the grassroots level, speaking with Chester's young people about the alternatives available to them. Good to have you with us, Jean-Pierre.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So why don't we begin by getting a sense of what's been happening in Chester, the population about 34,000, a third of whom live in poverty. Homicides are up this year, 26 at last count. And according to the Philadelphia Inquirer, the homicide rate in Chester is higher than that of either Philadelphia or Camden. Matthew, first to you, what are your thoughts as to why there are more gun deaths?
You know, I think it's the worst part of my job is having to meet with these families of homicide victims. And they ask me, you know, the same question, you know, why is there so much death and gun violence in Chester? And, you know, there's no clear answer to it. Coincidentally, you know, part of my job is to keep track of statistics in, you know, in Chester City, along with the Chester Police Department. And in fact, shootings are the lowest they've ever been at least over the past 5 years, which is where we've been maintaining the data. But obviously, homicides are more than they were last year and the year before, and about on level where they were back in 2017 and 2016. So it seems to be that, I don't know if it's an issue of, you know, some of these individuals being more brazen or just being more efficient, as awful as that is to say. But, you know, it's clear that there's underlying issues. And I think those underlying issues are what, you know, this partnership, CPSN, you know, aims to, you know, rectify or aims to address, because it's we got to stop being reactive and have to be a little more proactive in what we're trying to do, both as the district attorney's office, but also as, you know, Delaware County as a whole.
Jean-Pierre, you've lived most of your life in Chester. Weigh in here. What do you think is leading to the increase in deadly gun violence?
With this program, we're hoping to be able to bring forth a new light to the city, to give resources and opportunities to people that have been robbed of resources. You know, Chester is the only city in Delaware County, and Chester is a place where, you know everybody. Everybody knows everybody. So it's very hard to sit here and say, oh, okay, this is the reason. And like Matthew was just saying, right, it's very hard to pinpoint the exact reason, but we're hoping that with Chester Partnership for Safe Neighborhoods, we can bring the resources and talk to the young men and help the young man get his GED and let him know that I care and that we're here to talk to him. And hopefully that catches on and it hits the next person. Then I bring in more people. I have mentors and we begin to change how people view Chester, how people the residents of Chester view themselves.
Matthew Krause, how do prosecutors and police identify the young people most at risk for gun violence?
It's very much a partnership and a collaboration. There's a team that we have met with. We have met with, obviously, you know, Chester Police Department, and we have, you know, reviewed, you know, people carrying guns and people who have been convicted of firearms offenses. But we have also spoken with community members. We have, and what's in the plan and what JP is going to kind of lead and spearhead is a monthly meeting with all of the schools in the Chester school districts, in the hopes of identifying, you know, maybe people a little bit before when they're making that decision to pick up that gun or to go out on the street and commit those violent crimes. We have met with the intelligence officers and the data analysts, both from Chester Police Department as well as Delaware County's Criminal Investigation Division. And it's really a collaboration of input and intelligence from all facets of Chester life, because, you know, this isn't going to work unless there's buy-in, unless we have the right information, and we're trying to reach out to the right people that are driving this violence primarily. And we're, you know, we're confident and optimistic that we have identified that small number of high-risk individuals. And I say high-risk meaning those most likely to shoot someone as well as be shot themselves. Mm-hmm. And, you know, communicating that message that people care about you. People that, you know, haven't even met you yet care about you and care about your well-being and want to see you succeed, and we want to give you that opportunity. So I think by, you know, and that's really one of the emphasis of this program and what this is based off of, which was David Kennedy's model, who's actually a Swarthmore alum.
Yeah.
It is to, you know, if you speak to, you know, the worst of the worst, as it were, you are more likely and statistically, it's been proven that in other cities where this has been implemented to reduce that gun violence if you're going after that small, small number.
So these people who are identified are then invited to attend call-in meetings, I guess, to start the process of getting them onto a different path. Jean-Pierre, how do you open up a conversation? Are you going to be in the front line in terms of, once these young people are identified, then talking to them and trying to get them into this program?
Yes, ma'am. So when Matthew Krause, the Chester Police Department, the DA's office goes to the house, I'll be right there, right? They'll give their spill, and then I'll sit there and I'll tell them, listen, I can help you out with a lot of different things, but we have to take the time to figure out what exactly you need help with. So, yes, I will definitely be on the front line.
Are you concerned that some of these young people might not want to hear what you have to say? And if that's the case, what do you say to them?
I think persistence, right? Persistence and just going after them every day and calling them every day. Listen, just take my cell phone number there. Give me your cell phone number. I'll give you a call, right? And just giving them that fatherly, you know, shoulder that they can lean on, they can talk to. You know, a lot of our children from this area, right, they grow up without a father. Their father isn't there. And some their father is there, and he really just doesn't have the time, right? So it's difficult to sit there and say, you know, he doesn't care because he's never been given the option to care, right? So I'm giving him an option. I'm sitting there talking to him. I'm showing him different things. You know, I'm a two-time fella, right? I've been in trouble before. I've been upstate, and I realized that I didn't necessarily have to do it. I had compassion for my brothers that didn't have a lot, so I got involved with it. And now I'm here to make a complete change, a complete turnaround, and hopefully my community will follow me.
And Matthew Krause, if a young person still doesn't hear the message, then is what happens next? Is incarceration a very real reality?
Well, I think it's important to distinguish the fact that, you know, if they decide or they at you know, one point or another do not wish to take advantage of what we're offering them, these resources and connecting them with everything they need to, you know, to make better decisions and to find, you know, success. That doesn't mean that, you know, we're gonna lock them up or we're gonna arrest them. That's not the point. The point of, you know, what JP is doing is providing, you know, someone, providing a network of people and of resources and things that they can turn to. But, you know, we're not expecting, and kind of as you mentioned in your first question or your most recent question, Jean-Pierre, is, you know, what if they don't listen? We don't think a lot of people are going to believe us right away. We have to show them what we mean and show them that we do care. Actually, we were in the process of doing that prior to the pandemic hosting or co-hosting an expungement clinic down in Chester and as part of the DA's office, as well as a wipe out your warrants event, which we hope to get going, where you can, you know, turn yourself in and hopefully resolve your outstanding warrants, whether they be for traffic tickets or something more. And that was just going to be for the entirety of the Chester community, which we hope to do, you know, once things get back to the new normal in what we're dealing with. But the only time that, you know, the DA's office is going to come in and, you know, make arrests is when, you know, there's been illegal activity. Yeah. And we are going to do that when we know about a shooting incident or, God forbid, a homicide, and we're aware of who's responsible. We're going to prosecute them, and we are going to make sure that that case is handled by the most experienced prosecutors in our office. And we're also going to make sure that, you know, if convicted or if there's a guilty plea and it comes to sentencing, that the judge who is sentencing this offender has the most complete information about this person. So they might not have the extent of, you know, a long criminal record, but they might be driving the violence because they're bringing in, you know, kilos of heroin to Chester City, or they are the ones that are, you know, kind of calling the shots in any given neighborhood and putting and telling these younger individuals to, you know, take that gun or to take that package of drugs and bring it this, there, or the other.
Well, it does sound like the risk of incarceration is very real then for some of these young people if they don't accept perhaps what the program is offering. Let's get to just the civil liberties concerns regarding the identification of people before perhaps that they've committed a crime. Is this a reality, Matthew? Has this been expressed to you?
It has. And actually, we met with David Kennedy and we talked about this issue exclusively. And the idea is there's not, you know, a list. I mean, you use the term list in who you've identified as a high-risk offender. Mm-hmm. But the only reason that list exists is so we know who to contact initially to spread this message, because they have to understand that, you know, the consequences and the consequences that will come to their group or their gang, whatever you want to call it. I think it's important to know that there aren't really gangs in Chester, but more neighborhoods, you know, that this program exists and this partnership will, you know, change how we handle violent crime in our office. But other than that, you know, there's no special treatment, good or bad, for the people that we've identified that we can contact that we know are group affiliated. And so I think the fact that, you know, that information isn't really kept It's not shared. It's just for the initial contact and who we can spread our message to, almost a middleman of sorts for the neighborhoods. That we hope alleviates much of the concerns that you know that have been mentioned. And you know, I think David Kennedy has kind of signed on to this as that's the best way and most appropriate way to handle those concerns, which are legitimate. But we hope that, you know, they've now been alleviated with this process.
Jean-Pierre, there might well be some distrust among community members regarding government outreach. Do you think you might find that? And if so, how do you expect to handle it?
I expect to find that. I expect to find that in the different neighborhoods that I go in. But, you know, majority of the city knows me, right? I have a small internet radio station in the city, so they know that I'm not a part of the DA or a part of the police, right? So they know me. They know my character. They know what I stand for. So they know I'm coming to help them, right? So they don't have to deal with going to jail. They don't have to deal with all of those things. And I'm just hoping that they give me a chance to get it done.
Can, I think we talked about this a little bit in the start of the segment. So kind of taking a look at a small group of people rather than an entire neighborhood in regarding deadly gun violence, can doing this change the narrative for the community, how it perceives itself and how the outside world perceives it, Jean-Pierre?
Absolutely. Taking advantage of this program is something that has never happened in the city of Chester before. You know, Chester has been on the decline for years, right? And now the resources are available, the money is available, and somebody truly cares, right? So to take advantage of those resources, to not take advantage of those resources would be absolutely idiotic, right? To take advantage of them and to use them to get you to a place where you need to be is good. and I truly believe that this could happen, but we need people to be, you know, target members, right? People in the beginning, we need people to be, all right, listen, I'm for this. I'm going to go along with this program.
Matthew, when do you expect to launch this program?
So hopefully in the next 30 days. So we've done a lot of the, you know, intelligence gathering and the community outreach to kind of get out what our goal is for the Chester as a community, as well as for this partnership. And in the coming weeks, we are actually going to start rolling out our, you know, pandemic altered version of a call-in. Obviously a call-in is, you know, traditionally for there, a large group of people are brought in and they're spoken to by a number of individuals, including the DA, including myself, including Jean-Pierre, as well as the mother of a murder victim. So, you know, just to put a face to the violence. And we can't do that safely. And so what we're instead doing is we're identifying, you know, these individuals that we believe will be able to spread our message and going to their house individually, as well as going, bringing some of them into the district attorney's office and speaking to them in small groups. And then finally, actually going out into the community, because another way to get the message across is just to make sure the community is aware of this partnership and aware of what it can do for their, you know, sons, daughters, brothers, sisters. And so we'll be going to, and I actually was just down in Chester driving around, identifying all the most common spots that I'm sure, you know, JP knows of where people tend to congregate in each neighborhood. And so we're going to go out there, you know, hopefully beginning in November, shortly after the election, and actually, you know, go out there and just start talking to them, start communicating and sharing with them our message and answer any questions or concerns they might have. So the hope is, you know, it is out there in Chester City of what we're trying to do and how things will be done differently by well before year's end, but hopefully within the next 30 to 45 days.
All right, we're up against the clock, so we've got to wrap it up. Thank you so much for joining us. Matthew Krause, Deputy District Attorney for Delaware County. It was great to have you.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having us again.
And Jean-Pierre Bryce, Community Resource Consultant for the CPSN program about to be launched in Chester. Great to have you with us as well.
Thank you very much.
And as always, we invite you to join us on social media. Head to WHYY.org/Radio Times. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez. Our producer is John Ahrens. And I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks for listening. Be well.